propagating truth in a world of lies. You are listening to the John Age Project.
Welcome to the Anomic Age. I'm your host, John Age. It's my pleasure to be with you today, this evening, this afternoon, wherever you are, wherever you happen to be listening to the broadcast right now. Please check out AnomicAge.com for all things Anomic Age. You'll get the show links, the guests links, the me links. You can sign up for the newsletter, and most importantly, you can make a donation. Please do so. I jokingly say this, but it's not cheap. And I'm definitely doing this, not a for-profit gig, but I would definitely like to at least cover expenses around it. That'd be nice. So please check out AnomicAge.com. Links there on the bottom right. And you can make a donation to the Anomic Age. We got a terrific show for you today, as you might expect. But before we get into that, let's get into a little bit of news. I don't have the tremendous amount of news that we typically cover. I'm trying to sort of reel it back in. I kind of just have a lot of disturbances in the force, if you will, lately going on. It's just a lot of insanity when you leave the house. I know I covered this a lot last week. I felt like I went a bit on a diatribe about it, but it's crazy out there. Again, I went out this weekend to one of these establishments that's it's an international establishment. It's a store with their color schema being sort of a red and khaki. Looks like a big bullseye. I think you know what I'm talking about. Went to one of those establishments against my will. I don't like to shop there at all because they're the same folks that have moved everyone into one big gender. So now you don't know what you're buying, I guess. If you're looking at men's pants or women's pants, it's hard to tell these days because they look so effeminate. But I digress. Went there with the fam, trying to get some a few odds and ends and some gifts for a function we're going to next weekend. And I knew what I was in for because of where I was. I mean, I'm not an idiot, and I realize it's pretty easy to pick up when you're in enemy territory, so to speak. And it was just a whole lot of crazy. I was going to put these in the actual images of the show, but I decided against it. But if you're looking at, if you're thinking of going to that establishment with the big bullseye, you'll probably see this in the genderless clothes section. There's a nice display with hashtag Take pride. Oh, take pride. Well, yeah, we should take pride in a lot of things, but perhaps not what I'm thinking of. This is the take pride with the usual adulterated imagery and symbolism of the rainbow. Oh, embrace. Embrace. I feel like getting off air just hugging someone right now. Take pride. So it's obviously part of the mass indoctrination schema of the LGBT LMNOPs, right? That's what it's all about. That's what this is. You can't see this image. I should have probably just thrown them on the screen while we were talking about it. But yeah, it's a big rainbow scheme and all these rainbow colored clothes and a big hashtag take pride initiative there. And I thought, oh boy, just what I always wanted. More pride. But that wasn't it. There was more. We moseyed on over to the book section because you're thinking, oh, all right, it's books. It's got to be kind of all right now. No, it's not. You got to take note of where you are. You're in a communist-controlled area. You're in a communist-controlled area that's pushing their SJW bollocks at every possible point. So, we got from dear Chelsea Clinton, we got the books She Persisted. And then you got She Persisted Around the World. Ooh, embrace it. Embrace the diversity. Take pride, right? Embrace the diversity and love and communist agenda. I just feel all warm inside. Yeah, just take pride and persist, right? But that wasn't it. There was much, much more that nauseated me when I had to interact with the humans this past weekend. Oh, man, I'll save the worst for last, perhaps. We got also in the book section, we got Woke Baby. Oh, boy. You got to start indoctrinating your children quite young. So if you shop at one of these establishments, you're probably already in the fold. I'm pretty sure you're already in the fold of taking pride and supporting SJW commie events and all this kind of bollocks. So this will be par for the course for what you would want to indoctrinate your young into. So you would probably already have Woke Baby. Oh boy, but if you don't, oh, it's so stupid you just can't even imagine it. I took a picture of this because it was so idiotic. It's got a picture within the book. Well, I mean, I guess it's just a reading page within the book with the picture in context and such. But it's got a little black boy holding his fist up in the air. Oh, boy. On the reverse side there, it's got, look at your fists. Fingers curled into a panther's paw. Pointing up. 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 Reaching for justice. So this is what the kids are getting indoctrinated with. And I'm not even talking about the kids in the cult of academia getting that bollocks. I'm talking about the kids in the house. So like I've tried to point out again and again and again and again and again, it's not just the cult of academia. The problem is we have at least 5 to 6 generations that have been indoctrinated and indoctrinated so well within the cult that those same people are the ones that are professors, that are teachers, and that are, heck, just parents. So it transcends the cult of academia. Their plan is working perfectly because the kid gets the indoctrination within the cult of academia, and that also gets substantiated, legitimized, and otherwise within the home because the parents say, oh boy, let's get Woke Baby for little Junior there, and he can learn about how he's oppressed by those evil, racist conservatives and the creepy white guys. But wait, there's more. Oh, it just gets better all the time. There's baby feminists. Baby feminists. This was another great book you could purchase there at the Bullseye store. Baby feminists, oh boy. Because you want to always, always instill this underlying current of you're a victim. You're a victim. You're a victim. Because evil white guys or evil white women or somebody's holding you down and oppressing you. Specifically the evil white Christian conservative guys. Those are the worst possible people of all. I mean, they didn't do anything but oppress. That's it. I mean, when you look around at your environment, you should think and see one thing. Oppression and victimhood. And for Pete's sakes, embrace it and take pride in it. Win-win, right? Win-win. And we saw this in the toy section. And I mean, I laughed because it was funny. And I laughed because it made me uncomfortable and want to vomit. It's a child's game. And you see so much of this. I haven't seen this until I went into this lovely establishment. But I've seen more and more of this where these silly emojis of feces, the emoji of dung. For some reason, they have a lot of these emojis. They've created, I guess, like stuffed animals and silly stuff like that. So yeah, you can get a stuffed animal object, which is an emoji of feces. That's something cool that you want your kids to play with. Because, I mean, your kid's already indoctrinated with the idiot phone. So they're doing this all day. They're going, no, 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 no. That's their whole life. Their whole existence is sitting there on the idiot tap box machine like some sort of mentally handicapped parrot or a Pavlovian dog. But that's okay, right? Because the kid's out of your hair. So that means you have more time to play with your own little idiot box. Like, oh, good, the kid's in the corner tapping away at the stupid box that's blinking colors at it. That gives me more time to play with my own Facebook and Twitter and all kinds of idiot devices and games on my own stupid box. That's the point. So you are not going to be a parent. You're going to be a fool on your box. And your kid can be a fool too. So you get them involved as early as possible. And they're using colorful emojis and all this sick, demented stuff, right? And then they want to emulate that and have those as animals and such. So you can get your kid who's addicted to the device because it rewires their brain and makes them more suggestible and puts them in that alpha state so their brain's really mushy and just soaks in all the stupidity. So you're doing all that. Win-win. Good parenting year of the year award there. But also, it gets better because then you can buy the kid the feces stuffed animal. That's cool, right? So your kid's a moron on the box playing around like an idiot. You're a moron playing around like an idiot. And you get to, when you're not playing with that stupid device, you get to play with poo-poos. Awesome! I mean, who wouldn't want to do that? All right, back to the point of me talking about dung for 10 minutes. Here's the game. I took a picture of it. I should post it. I'll post all these on my Twitter. I'm not going to post them here on the show. But you can tune into the Twitter, and I'll put it under my disturbing thoughts of the week, I guess. I don't know. This is called Flushing Frenzy. Push the plunger till the poop pops up. I'm not making this up, people. This is real. It says, oh boy, toilets included. Poop, there it is. That's what's on the front of the box. And you can visually see, because there's a clear cutout on the box, you can see a plunger and a smiling piece of poo-poo. Yeah, it's there in the little plastic cutout. You can see the smiling poo-poo. And then on the sort of side piece of the box there, it's a big smiling piece of poo-poo. And two glee-filled little boys and girls. Hallelujah. It's so sick, folks. I don't even know what to say sometimes. But I do, actually. I feel almost physically ill when I have to go out in public and interact with these people. And the more you actually pull the curtain back and sort of peer, like, what in the heck's going on? Those people are crazy. You see why they're crazy. You see why people are the way they are. It's because of this. It's because of the tap-tap idiot light box that everyone carries around that tracks them and listens to them and, you know, takes away several amendments, but who cares? And because, you know, they've abdicated their responsibility of being a parent so they can just be cool. That's what everyone, we want to be cool. I mean, I've gone to the park a few times recently and it's the same stuff. This is not a surprise to me. It's just sort of, oh, it's that again. But I'm the only parent at the park that's like playing and interacting with my child because I want to be that parent, you know, like I aspire to actually be a parent and a good parent. I don't want to just say, all right, get out of here. You go play amongst your friends, all right? I'm going to be here playing with my box. But that's what's going on, man. I mean, that's the reality of every park that I go to. It's me playing with my kid. It's everybody else not even talking amongst themselves. That would be silly enough. No, they're playing with their light box. Play with your little light box. I'll be over here playing with my child. Enjoy. Enjoy, I guess, being a moron. I don't know what else to say. I've gotten a little cynical and a little darker as the show's progressed, but not really. I've just kind of become more open about my feelings of dread and anger, rage, irritation. What can you say? I mean, that's our current society. And what really disgusts me to the core is that no one seems to get it. I got more. I'll pull myself in, you know. I'll try to reel it back. Some more stuff I found particularly disturbing. I guess this is a national campaign. I'm sure all of these companies are A, run by social justice warrior idiots that have been indoctrinated in the aforementioned methodologies of the cult of academia, parents, friends, peers, so forth, movie, technology, television show, music, all that stuff. They have created this monster. So I'm sure that these corporations are probably doing this on their own, and if they're not, they're getting some great government subsidies to push this kind of total and utter poppycock. So I found this, I believe it was last week. I don't know, after the show last week. Anyway, nonetheless, Listerine is doing their own LGBT LMNOP ad campaign. Yes! What I've always wanted in my mouthwash is social justice and consciousness and action. Now, I don't really care if it's giving me fluoride or making my IQ lower or even if it's helping with the breath. No, we want social action out of our mouthwash, and Listerine is coming forward. Forward, right, Barry Satoro? To fill that gap. So this is what we got. We got Listerine in the rainbow colors. Oh, goody. This is getting really good now. So what's got on here? What's it got? Peace, harmony, life. All these lovely buzzwords are on the rainbow colored Listerine. Wow, bro, I'm feeling better already, man. I feel like taking pride and embracing it all. Thank you, Listerine. I was kind of unsure, but now I'm getting with the program. That's what I'm doing. But wait, they're not alone. The Daily Wire. Here we got the Daily Wire. Bud Light selling rainbow bottles to benefit GLAD. Oh, I'm glad. For Pride Month. Bud Light has been a supporter of the LGBT LMNOP community since the 80s. Yeah. It's booze, people. It's booze. They want you to be a moron idiot so you can drink more of their product. I mean, it's a booze company. It'd be like a weed company, a booze company, a liquor company, whatever. The impetus of these companies isn't to make you smarter, more informed, or better as a person. The impetus of these companies is to dilute your intelligence, to make you more compliant and pliable for, I don't know, the state? Again, I touched on this last week. I mean, that's why you're never going to see a revolution in this country. You're never going to see it. So people keep wondering when it's going to happen, where it's going to... I've posed this question time and time again myself, and I know the answer. It's a rhetorical question because I'm so filled with angst. The answer is never. As long as the public is well medicated with the booze, the drugs, the sex, the porn, the TV shows, the Dancing with the Stars, the sports, whatever, whatever you want to fill in that blank of as being your thing, as long as that's still going down, there will never, ever, ever be any revolution at all. Not happening, not even once. And if anyone did actually stand up at all, first they'd be snuffed out. But secondly, if a large enough movement gained steam for this, then they'd immediately start pulling one of these aforementioned things. So they'd say, oh, well, you can't get your prescription meds anymore. You can't get your, oh, I got my card for my weed anymore. Oh, I'm going to just go to the store and get some booze anymore. Oh, I'm going to turn on the game anymore. They'd start pulling that stuff back. That's all it would take. They would not need to use directed energy weapons or any sort of extreme low-frequency weapons or any of that stuff that people think of when they think of this is how they're going to get us, or drones or what have you. No, all they have to do is pull back that stuff, and the populace will cower in fear like the sheep they are on the ground. That's all it'll take. Guaranteed. But let's move on. I know you're getting too dark again, John. I wish you'd start lying to us like everyone else. No, I'm not going to lie to you. I'd like you to actually be informed and know the truth of what's going on. But I know that makes me pretty scary, racist, bigoted, such, so forth, so on. But the point of all this is that it is a culture war. So make no mistake about it. People have this misconception of what a war is. And they think, you know, it immediately conjures up images of World War II or the Vietnam War. Excuse me, the Vietnam conflict. They don't call it a war. Fill in the blank of all of the mess that we've been playing around in the Middle East for 20 plus years. That, whatever you want to deem that conflict to be. Most people think of that when they think of a war. But that's not it. The culture war is going on around you all the time. Feel free to pay attention. A war doesn't have to mean bullets flying by your head and tanks rolling through the streets. That's the perception. The reality is that they're going to destroy you before that even happens, so that when you do see those things occurring, you'll be too weak to even resist. So the culture war is what's really going on. So the culture war is you get 12 plus years of indoctrination. Your parents and grandparents had those same 12 years plus of indoctrination. So you got the family being SJW communist fools. Then the child has about 1% chance of not turning out like dear old mom and dad. And any chance of not turning out like that is going to be quelled, because they'll be going to the indoctrination centers too. And when they look at their social media feed and their YouTube or what have you, all those channels are going to be censored. They're already being censored, and that is going to continue exponentially to occur. So when little Sally and Bobby look to those things, they're only going to see the echo chamber of what they want you to see. You feel me? Yeah, the Ministry of Truth, it's not a fictitious thing. They might call it something different, Threat Fusion Center, what have you. That's what's up. That's what's going on. So they're not even going to see those options when they look at their social media or video device or what have you. So they're going to go with the K-12 plus of indoctrination. Their parents and grandparents are going to legitimize and substantiate those same idiotic claims. And anyone who doesn't fit in with that paradigm, well, they're going to be subject to the groupthink. So they're going to be the oddball out in every single circle, whether it be church, social functions, the cult of academia, the workplace, and so forth. So you're going to be seen as that pariah, that odd person out, much like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So when they see you for what you are, a free-thinking individual, they're going to immediately shriek and point at you, just like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So that's what's going on. Like, that's where we're at. That's why I say it's a culture war. That's what's up. That's where it is. That's what it has been for quite some time. That's why when you go to your big box store, whose logo is a big bullseye, you're going to see the stuff that I just pointed out to you. And you're going to see the same thing at box store X, Y, Z, and so forth and so on. It's going to be the same message. It's going to be the same message when you turn on your idiot box at night to relax. It's going to be the same message on the Netflix idiot box. It's going to be the same message from the sports stars that you iconically follow like a bunch of lemmings off a cliff. It's going to be the same bleeping message on the radio or on whatever music device you're looking at the time. It's the same message, and it will be the same message. So it is a culture war for your thoughts, for your life. Please feel free to avail yourself of the truth. And I don't really know how to tell you to react to this other than to disconnect. Your silence is your consent. So stop consenting. Whatever that means for whatever I just discussed, whether it be the music, the sports, the school, all those are elements of your consent. So by continuing to participate in those events and sacrifice your children and yourself and your monies to those things, you are saying, yes, sir, I will. So stop. I know it's hard. It's a bitter pill to swallow. I mean, it's just like getting on a diet. It's just like turning vegetarian. It's just like stopping swearing or whatever you're trying to do in your life to sort of curb your human nature. whatever that is, it's not easy. It's not supposed to be easy. So when I say try to stop supporting these entities, that's a big chunk of wax. So you're not going to do it overnight, most likely. But if you can stop going to that bullseye store, maybe that's a way to go. I don't know. If you can stop going to the sporting events, or if you can stop sitting there like a fill in the blank and spending 8 hours a day looking at it, that's an option too. If you can spend more time with your family, if you can spend more time in prayer, if you can spend more time in whatever is bringing you closer to the light and further away from the dark, then that's definitely what I think you need to do. And it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be an incremental change, just as you have been changed incrementally to become what you are now. So I always say, when you look into the abyss, not my quote, obviously, I think it's Dante's Inferno. If you're looking into the abyss doesn't change. The abyss changes you. So think about it.
Don't
be a part of the problem. Be a part of the solution and stop consenting to the tyranny. Now, enough being said about that. We got two great guests for you today, which we'll be joining with both of them in just a moment. We've got Mr. Jordan Page, a musician, a singer, a songwriter, an activist, all things and more for Mr. Jordan Page. He's going to be speaking with us. And like last week and in the coming weeks as well, we're going to be talking with Alan Myers for a little bit and getting into all things Fed and all things economics, banking, and otherwise. Stick around. Thank you for tuning in to the program. Check out AnomicAge.com and share that link with your friends. We'll talk to our guest in a mere matter of moments. Thanks. It is my pleasure to welcome Jordan Page onto the Anomic Age today. Jordan is a national recording and touring artist who performs a mixture of rock and folk music that has captivated audiences all over the world. He is known for headlining at major protests and rallies in support of freedom, peace, and limited government. As a political activist, Page has championed many freedom causes, ranging from anti-war initiatives to gun rights, to medical cannabis freedom, to Bitcoin. And he is known as a leading voice of liberty in America. Please visit jordanpagemusic.com for more information. And if you're wondering, all those links will be in guest media on AnomicAge.com too. So if you're driving down the road or listening to this at the gym, fear not. It'll all be on the guest media links for you. Jordan, thank you so much for being on the program today. It's a pleasure to have you on, sir.
Thanks for having me, John.
Absolutely. It's great to have you on. Well, you're definitely new to the audience, or at least my audience anyway. So I hate to say the obvious, but how'd you get into all this? How'd you get into the music game and the freedom, liberty, anti-big governments, pro-freedom logic stuff that every American should be interested in?
Sometimes I wonder that myself. How did this happen? Well, I've been a musician since I was about 11, 12 years old. The Doors were my first love, the Jim Morrison and the Doors. I just fell in love with that music when I was a kid. And I was writing songs by age 13, I guess, and learning to play the guitar and just pouring all of my teen angst into the instrument and into my songwriting. And I've always wanted to play music. It's always been my passion in life, and it's always been what I wanted to do. I had no aspirations of being a political activist of any kind. In fact, for most of my life until about age 26, I really was apolitical and just thought people that were always protesting just had nothing better to do. Sometimes it's amazing to me that I took this turn in my life, but it happened because of a song. I can tell you that. In 2006, December the 1st of 06 to be exact, I had a dream, and I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I walked into my office half asleep and I wrote this piece of prose, you know, and I didn't realize that it was a song at first, and you know, just threw a chorus in there that just made sense, and boom, it was an instant song. I was sure that people were going to hate it because it was political, and I was not a political guy, and I was sure people were going to boo me off the stage if I played it. But I had to try. It was too far outside of my understanding to have been an accident. You know, it was like this song was like a gift from God. And I played it at a sold-out show I had in December, just a couple weeks after I wrote it. And the audience had a tremendous reaction to it. The song's called Pendulum. Mm-hmm. And I had a standing ovation. It was the only song of the night that got a standing ovation from the entire audience.
Nice.
And it was deafening, quite frankly. It was so loud, they were freaking out. And I don't want to say I heard a voice, but it was kind of like I heard a voice saying, "These people know what this song is about. Can you see?
Yeah, you like see? This is it. That eureka moment everyone now, hopes for."
Right, but you, meaning me,
yeah,
you don't know what this song is about. You need to go find out what this song is about. These people get it, and now it's time for you to go figure it out. Man. And so I dove headfirst down the rabbit hole and never came up. And I started writing anti-war songs, and just I started learning everything I could learn. I watched every documentary there is. I read as many books as I could get my hands on. I listened to speeches and podcasts and you name it. I was just reading and reading and writing and writing for like 2 years. And all of 2007 and 8 was spent in deep research mode, writing mode. And then I discovered Ron Paul. And I was invited to come and perform at the Revolution March in D.C. in front of the Capitol on the National Mall in D.C. And there were 15,000 people showed up, and this showed me that there was a movement. I thought I was going to have to start a movement. I was so naive and out of touch. I didn't know that there was a liberty movement already, and I was kind of relieved to see there was already a movement. But it really showed me that there was a purpose in all this, like a kind of a cosmic celestial purpose to all this. And my life had completely changed. And the song was being played on XM radio all over the world. And I was getting letters from people all over the world saying, "This song, it speaks to me, and it says so perfectly what I've been feeling," and those kind of comments. And I'm thinking to myself, man, I didn't even write this song. Like, this song wrote itself. My fingers were moving. And that was the middle of the night, and I was half asleep when I wrote this. I didn't even know what it was about until after I played it for somebody, you know. So those are the kinds of things that showed me I was on a higher path. And you know, I did more and more shows with Ron Paul, and eventually they invited me to be part of the presidential campaign in 2011 and 2012, and I did maybe a couple dozen major events with him and in front of some really big crowds, and it was just like, you know, one of the highlights of my life. It was great. And I went from playing in bars for, you know, 30 people who were drunk and who could have cared less that I was there,
yeah,
to playing for 3,000 to 12,000 people who all know the words to my songs, and I was getting paid 10 times as much, and just like being really fulfilled. And it was all signs pointed that this was the path.
Absolutely.
You know, like speaking the truth, writing songs about liberty, writing songs about the world, and not just songs about me and my life, but writing songs about you and me and all of us together and what's going on in the world. You know, and people were you know, kind of comparing me to people like Bob Dylan and Phil Oakes and those kinds of folks, the anti-war protest singers. And that was cool. Those were all influences for me. But that was sort of the style. Plus, you know, but I also did do a lot of stuff with like a hard rock edge too. Yeah, I always say I'm like Metallica meets Bob Dylan.
Wow, man, that's not bad. Not bad company.
Yeah, and I still do it. You know, I don't tour as much as I was touring. I mean, I was gone for, you know, just 3 weeks out of the month for 11 years, and I was just touring all over the country and internationally, and I was missing a lot of time with my kids and my wife. And so, you know, about 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, I took a break, and I got into some other businesses, and I'm still writing songs. I'm still releasing stuff, but I haven't been touring like crazy. I just did a tour in February in March of this year, in Florida. And I'm planning some other stuff. I'm going to be in Arizona in July. I'll be at the Porcupine Freedom Festival, all the bunch of those Pork Fest, which is a large anarchist gathering in New Hampshire, and in June. So I'm still performing and writing, but I've been kind of tending to my flock here. You know, my wife and I have seven kids, and you know, we're raising, you know, all these Liberty babies, and that's the most important stuff that I'm doing. I'm also a hemp farmer, and I've been fighting for cannabis freedom, medical cannabis freedom, for quite a few years now. And someone named a strain of cannabis after me, which was a real trip. That was really funny. But I grow hemp out here on my farm, and you know, we raise animals and goats and chickens and geese and whatnot. But the story continues. You know, whenever there's an important song that needs to be written, it usually hits me, and I'll put it out, you know, and that's kind of where I'm at now.
Wow, man, that's a pretty amazing story in and of itself. I can relate to you on so many levels of that, because if you'd asked me this probably 12, 15 years ago, would I be doing this or have this sort of stuff? And I'd say, what are you talking about? Because when I was younger, I had no, I want to say I was apolitical, I guess. I didn't care. I know that sounds really sad, you know, in your 20s and even early 30s. I was like, yeah, whatever. And then I finally, you know, kind of came to grips with it all. And I was like, wow, there's so much I didn't know. And then I went down that road like you did and just started, like, feasting on all these documentaries and books and podcasts and information. And I was like, man, I was an idiot for, like, 20 years. What was I doing wrong?
Better late than never, John. You know, as they say.
True, man.
You know, you're on the right road now. So am I. I mean, since 2006, so it's been it'll be 13 years this December since I had that experience, and you know, my life has never been the same. And but I'm glad. Like where was my life going? It wasn't going anywhere.
Totally agree. I don't even know if I get into this. How did your peer network take this? Did you lose friends on this? Did you gain more friends? I don't know.
I lost tons of people, family members, friends, but I gained way, way more. I mean, I've got a global family now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can go to just about every state and set up some shows, and people will come. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. I'm by no means like a household name, but you know, I can go pretty much anywhere and get a crowd to come and jam out with me for the night. You know, I'm just trying to stand for something. It's like I kind of had this dream a while back that, you know, my music didn't really become super prevalent until after I died, you know, and like, you know, in my children's time and my grandchildren's time, eventually.
Yeah.
That my music will be really needed then. So I'm just trying to build a catalog of songs that will give people hope and direction and strength in times of conflict and oppression, which I believe is coming and is, well, it's already here, but I think we haven't really seen anything yet. I think that the oppression we see now is going to be a happy memory compared to what's coming. And so it's important to me to build a catalog of work that future generations can use and sing to be inspired when those times of tribulation and trials are upon them. And that's kind of what I'm doing. And so, like I said, whenever something important happens, I'll usually write a song about it. I'm writing like, you know, three or four songs at a time right now. But I just put out a song in March about a political prisoner here in the United States. His name is Schaefer Cox. And he was one of our people. He's a Ron Paul libertarian from Alaska. He was a young politician in his 20s, running for office, really kicking butt. I mean, just inspiring huge crowds to come. The same kind of stuff that inspired us to Ron Paul. Mm-hmm. This guy embodied all that, only he was in his 20s. Really exciting kind of guy. And while he was running for a state seat, you know, he got, I think, 38% of the vote on his first run. And while he was running for office, he became aware of a major underground child trafficking and drug trafficking ring being perpetrated through CPS and the courts in Alaska and elected officials and businessmen who were trafficking in children. And he, you know, did the one thing that you don't do when you're poking the bear, and that's what he named names. And he was calling people out in public places, saying who they were and what they were doing. And so the FBI put him under investigation. They had him under investigation for about 2 years. Schaefer there were two informants that infiltrated his circle and were recording conversations for about 2 years. And that when they don't have anything to charge you with, because they tried to get him to incite him to violence. They tried to get him to, you know, to commit some sort of violent act and threatening, getting his life threatened and whatnot. His children were threatened. But he, even then, he wouldn't commit a crime. And he has a famous quote that if they ever come for me, I'm going to pull a Gandhi, not a Rambo.
I like it.
And they couldn't get him for anything because he didn't do anything. And so when they don't have anything on you, they charge you with conspiracy. And so they charged Schaefer with conspiracy to murder federal agents and solicitation to murder federal agents, as well as some weapons charges, which were bogus also. And one of the most important things about Schaefer's case is that his case was an Alaska state case. It was a state case, okay. And it was thrown out for lack of evidence. So he wasn't even found guilty or not guilty. The court threw it out because there was no case against him.
Yeah.
And while he was still incarcerated, the federal government superseded its own jurisdiction and tried him again illegally in federal court because they don't have the legal right to try someone for this. The federal government doesn't have the jurisdiction to do this, but they did it anyway. They pulled an old judge out of retirement because they couldn't get any federal judges to hear the case because it had already been thrown out. So then they get this old guy out of retirement to hear this case, and they gave him instructions on what they wanted him to do.
Of course.
And he refused to allow all the tapes that the FBI had of Schaefer. They refused to allow those tapes to be played. And the prosecution withheld 500 pages of exculpatory evidence that proved Schaefer's innocence. So the jury never got to hear any of this. They also moved the trial from Alaska down here to Washington, so that none of Schaefer's witnesses could get here to testify on his behalf. So you have the criminal justice system weaponized against a man that truly threatened their dirty secret, which is Pizzagate.
Yeah.
And they found him guilty, and the judge gave him 26 years. And that's part one of his story. Part two is they sent him to a CMU, to a communications management unit, which is basically a black site secret prison outside of congressional oversight and approval. So Congress never approved these prisons. These are prisons within prisons. They call them Little Guantanamo because when Guantanamo Bay was supposedly shut down, which I don't believe it was, but when it was supposedly shut down, they moved all those guys that were there who are all like ISIS members,
gotcha,
to these locations. So you have all of these radical ISIS, radical Muslim terrorists in these CMUs on American soil, and they have to put a small number of what they call balancers or non-Muslims into these prisons in order to not be accused of having only one demographic of prisoner. And Schaefer Cox is this famous prisoner, and he's in there with these guys. So there's like five or six Christians in this prison, and the rest are all like radical Muslim, like terrorist type people. And so back in October last year, Schaefer and his allies were in a room praying with a Bible and singing hymns, and they get ambushed by this massive group of like 25 guys or so of these other prisoners, who then seize one of the men, tie his hands behind his back. They stabbed him in the heart, and they cut his head off with a prison garrote. And they grabbed another guy, and they stabbed him 12 times. He miraculously survived. How he survived, I don't know. But he miraculously survived. And it took 15 minutes for the SWAT team to scramble while the guards hid in like a locked room, like a panic room. And they leave these guys to just be butchered. And so you've got an ISIS murder happening on American soil in an American prison, and the guards do literally nothing to stop it at all. Schaefer leaked this information to his legal team, and they put him in a dungeon for 30 days in pitch black dungeon as punishment for that. So we've been just talking about it on as often as we can, as many programs as we can, because this stuff has to stop. Number one, you got an innocent man in literally one of the worst prisons in the world, which is in America, and who's being religiously persecuted, not just by the inmates, but also by the prison staff. There, he's being persecuted by them too. And a major development in his case is that one of the judges in his resentencing has ordered that all that evidence that they wouldn't let to be shown at his trial, they've ordered it to be released. And so he has a resentencing in November, this November in 2019. And we are hoping that this exculpatory evidence that is being released will lead to his exoneration and his release from this prison. And so so last year I was at an event and somebody gave me a book. And I heard Schaefer's name in the past, but I didn't know anything about him. And they gave me a book called The Lost Lyrics of Schaefer Cox. And I read this book, and it was songs that he had written in another facility that he was in before he was moved to where he is now in Terre Haute, Indiana. And these lyrics had been left behind because they came and took him away and relocated him to another unit. And he thought that these lyrics were lost forever. But somebody, either a guard or a prisoner, we don't really know who, found these lyrics, read them, and were so moved by them that they smuggled them out of the prison. And they got them into Schaefer's team's hands, who published them into a book. That book ended up in my hands. I read it and was deeply inspired by it. And I wrote a song called The Persecution of Schaefer Cox. And I approached his foundation, Schaefer's Angels, about helping me to get it recorded and do a music video, which they loved the idea. They loved the song. And they went ahead and they helped me to produce it. And we released this music video on March 10th this year, like a couple months ago, which was the anniversary of his unlawful arrest. And so now we're doing a nationwide media campaign to raise awareness of Schaefer's case. We want to send people to freeschaefer.com. You can watch the video there. It's really beautifully done. You can read all about him. You can watch documentaries about him. You can order his books from there. And you can donate, most importantly, to his legal defense fund. Because that's where the real battle is. Other than prayer, that's where the real battle is. And we're asking people to go there and donate to the fund. You can get the song on iTunes and Amazon, anywhere you download music, CD Baby. Go and download the song. 50% of every sale goes to Schaefer's Legal Defense Fund. Because I took several lines from his book and I inserted them into the song. So he's a co-author of the song, which is really cool to have him be part of.
That sounds amazing. I like it. I can't believe all the stuff you just told me. I mean, I knew a little bit. I had spoken with Rudy Davis. You might be familiar with him. He was a staunch defender.
Yeah, Rudy is an expert on this case, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I spoke with him a while back. I loved everything he was bringing to the table, and then I found out about your work, and I was like, well, I got to talk to you, too, and get more information on this. I had no idea about this guy getting decapitated in the prison and the guard standing down. It's not surprising, but I guess still when you hear this stuff, it's just like a lot. Man, that's heavy, man. Jeez.
Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, do I burden people's souls with it? Yeah. Unfortunately, I have to because this information needs to see the light of day. When I first was told about this murder, I had already been working with Schaefer's Angels and was like, you know, kind of like opening myself up to write the song. And then I got that information and I felt this crushing feeling in my chest, hearing about this and thinking about what that must have been like for Schaefer, this gentle, peace-loving person, to witness his friend being stabbed and decapitated in front of his eyes. He told me that it was so close that he could smell the blood. I mean, it was that close. And like, what kind of experience that must have been for him. And I tried to put myself in his shoes mentally, spiritually, emotionally. And I drew from that trauma for that, that he experienced to write the song. So the song is very passionate, very beautiful, emotional, talking about, you know, someday soon I'll be free. What a day that will be. And just talking about the injustice that had been done to Schaefer. But talking about this murder, it's important because for so many reasons, but not the least of which is they're trying to cover it up. The prison is trying to cover it up. The FBI is trying to cover it up. It needs to be talked about. This needs to stop. You know, Schaefer told me that most of the prisoners that come to the CMU are not Muslims. All the new prisoners that come in are not Muslims, but they all end up converting to Islam to avoid being murdered and persecuted. But that he and a small handful of guys have resisted that and have, they'll never betray Jesus Christ, they'll never betray God, and they'll never do that. They'd rather die than do that. And I really identified with that as well. And that all just kind of played into what was in my heart when I wrote the song. And so I really want people to check it out. It's on YouTube. It's at freeschaefer.com. It's at jordanpagemusic.com. That's my website where you can hear all my stuff. Just click on the audio page. The video for Schaefer's song is on the homepage. So the first thing you'll see is that. And I would just encourage people to share that. And freeschaefer.com is where you can donate to the Legal Defense Fund. That's what we really need. We need people buying the song to go to the fund, and we need people donating directly to the fund. And you know, Schaefer's got four different appeals right now, and you know, that he's fighting, and as well as his resentencing, which is coming up at the end of the year. So the more people know about this, the better. We want to spread the word about this. That, you know, you can contact the governor of Indiana, state senators, congressmen. We ask people not to contact the prison directly, because when people call the prison and harass them, they punish Schaefer physically and psychologically. They use the same tactics in this prison they did in Guantanamo. They do 4-point shackling to their beds. They do stress positions, shackling and stress positions. They do extreme temperature differentiation, where it's so hot you can't touch the floor with your feet, or too cold, so cold that it freezes the water in the toilet. They do sleep deprivation. They do starvation techniques. Schaefer has scurvy. And many of the other prisoners have scurvy, which is a starvation-related disease.
Yeah,
they do not get enough calories, and they're all just wasting away. They torture these guys. They do. It's torture. And you know, the chaplain walks around with a bulletproof vest, and Schaefer's walking around in a t-shirt. It is one of the most dangerous places that there is. And one of our brothers is there, who is a liberty-loving person, who believes in the rule of law and the Constitution. He's a son of a pastor. He's a husband. He's a father of two small children who he hasn't seen in 8 years. And he's been in prison for 8 years now. So we're really hopeful that he will be released. And I hope that this song plays even some small part in that effort. So we're excited for people to hear it and to share it and to learn more about Schaefer and his story.
Absolutely. I can't say enough good stuff about that. That's amazing. What I wanted people to understand is just to digest this, because like you were saying, like you and I are kind of old hats to this, so it's not that shocking, but I feel like there's the whole, I hate to pigeonhole them, but the Fox News crowd, the 50 to 70, 80, whatever demographic, whatever you want to put on it, you know, they're hearing this and going, what? There's these prisons in America where they have people tortured and they have people doing deprivation and all this mess that you think of as, that's just something that happens over there. It doesn't happen here. It happens in that little spot off Cuba, or it happens in a foreign country. But here in America, we're above that. We don't do that kind of stuff. But yet, we're doing it. We're doing it to American people here in America. And people don't even know about it. I think that's the biggest thing, that people just don't even know the information, which is so sad.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I'm in touch with Schaefer. We email back and forth, and I've gotten to speak to him on the phone once. He gets 2 15-minute phone calls a week, and he also can has access to email, I think, once or twice a week. And that's as much communication with the outside world as he has. When his mother visits him, she's not allowed to touch him. It's behind glass. He hasn't touched another human being that loves him, you know, one of a family or friend, in 8 years. So it's a really, really hard situation. Plus he's locked in with people who want to kill him all day long.
Yeah.
You know, it's all the Christians in the prison have a death warrant, essentially, from the Muslim groups that are there, and they're always on high alert because they could be killed any day. So the urgency is real. I got a chance to play the song for Schaefer over the phone
nice.
A couple months ago, and he could hear my kids in the background playing, you know, and he told me that the sound of children laughing is like this unknown lost sound that when he was hearing the song, he hasn't heard like a song performed, you know, live in as many years. And he said that listening to that song that I wrote for him and listening to my kids playing in the background while he was listening to it reminded him that there was a real world out there beyond the cold, godless walls of that prison, and that he had lost the ability to cry like years ago. Cause you know, put yourself in his shoes, like some part of you is going to die inside, you know, being in a place like that. And he said that he had lost the ability to cry years ago, but that hearing their voices in my song made him feel like he could cry again. And that's one of those moments where it's like, okay, if I wasn't all in before, I'm all in now, you know?
100%.
I care about him very much, and I want to see him released, and I want to sing this song with him on stage in front of thousands of people, with him as a free man. And so that's what we're working towards, and that's what I'm really focused on right now, besides my family and activism and all the things that I'm doing. Like that's the song that we're promoting right now, and the cause that we're promoting, and just want to bring as many people into knowledge about Schaefer as possible. So go to freeschaefer.com.
That sounds good. Just a couple more, because I know you got to go soon too. I hope everybody's getting this as far as the psychological ramifications of this. I feel like it's such a disconnect. Even you and I and probably people listening, they can't even grasp the sort of psychological damage that must occur when somebody has to live like this. Because, I mean, you and I can get up and go get a glass of water and nobody's going to kill us in the kitchen, hopefully. And we can go to the store and get some food and all this stuff, you know, that we just take for granted. I mean, this gentleman's been in prison for years now. He's waking up every day in deplorable conditions. Everyone around him wants him dead. I mean, not to mention the stress positions, the heat and cold, the scurvy, for Pete's sakes. Come on. That's just heavy. I hope this weighs on everybody. I mean, I don't want it to to put people in a state, but I want people to get in a state because I want people to get upset about this and try to help you and help him to get out of this horrible situation. This is just heavy, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's always hope, and Schaefer is a very godly man, a very very strong in his faith, and he said that he wouldn't trade this experience, because it has strengthened his relationship with God like more than he ever imagined. He said that if the door opened tomorrow and he could walk out, of course he would walk right out. But that if he was given the opportunity to turn back time and not have gone through this, he said he wouldn't, because he has learned what it really means to be a Christian. And that has made him, you know, ultimately stronger than he ever believed that he would be. He's really an amazing guy. I encourage everyone to learn about him. He's just an incredible human being. So, I mean, sometimes I feel like my faith is new in the box compared to his, you know. But I believe very, very strongly that God directed me towards Schaefer and towards this cause. And and applied my talents towards it, and that's what I'm doing. And you know, a lot of people have told me to be careful and, you know, watch out, you know, I mean, whatever. And I tell them, like, first of all, if I wasn't already on a list, then I'd be doing something wrong.
That's the way I always refer to it, too.
Second off, you know, I always ask people, I was like, if it was you that was falsely accused of something and you were rotting in some prison where everyone wanted to kill you, wouldn't you want me to write a song about you? Wouldn't you want people to speak your name and know about you and be praying for you and be thinking about you and, like, talking about you? Like, wouldn't you want that? Wouldn't you want me to do that for you? So,
yeah,
I mean, you can't live in fear.
That trauma-based mind control and that MK Ultra kind of works two ways. You know, it works on the person you're doing it on, but it also works as a nice chilling effect for everybody else, because everyone else goes, we better not poke our head out of the rabbit hole or they're going to get us like they got this guy, or we better just go along to get along sort of situation.
Yeah.
And I fear I already know the answer to this question, but what, if anything, happened with this this pedophilia ring that he was trying to expose? Do you know?
I'm sure it's still going on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these people are so well protected. If anyone has done any research on Pizzagate or child sex trafficking and satanic cults and the international ring that goes on, it's just the worst things you can ever imagine. And it is real, and I've done enough research into it and talked to enough people who are you know, actively fighting it to know what's really going on. And it is the scariest crap there is. You know, it's the most well-funded, well-protected, non-secret that there is. And I'm sure those people are still at it and still doing what they're doing. But luckily, more and more people are exposing it. More and more people are coming forward who've survived it, who are naming names. A lot of these people end up dead, you know? I mean, a lot of famous people who have been trying to expose it in Hollywood and whatnot, you know, they do so and then they end up dead. But they're getting the information out there, and the world is waking up, and that's a big part of why you're seeing all these YouTube channels getting shut down, and why you're seeing all these Facebook groups getting shut down, because you're getting millions of views on these videos about this stuff, and that means we're winning. And when they shut us down because, you know, we're waking enough people up, that means you're winning. That's how you know. I think a lot of people know about it now. It's not just, you know, a small handful of dedicated folks who are doing the research. Now it's like millions and millions of people know, and they're horrified by it, because it is horrifying. I mean, I am horrified by it, but I look at it like, you know, these are the people that we've been fighting all along. These are the people that are setting these, you know, ridiculous monetary policies. These are the people that benefit from wars and fund both sides of wars. These are the people that are putting out all this horrible propaganda to children through indoctrination camps, otherwise known as government schools. I mean, it's the same group, these elite groups that are behind it, and they're just expanding their territory while we sit on our butts not knowing what to do. And, you know, that time is coming to an end, and more people are waking up and ready to take action against it. And, you know, and Schaefer was one of these people that was speaking out against it, and he's paid the price. But there is a ray of hope here. And the more widespread that this song gets and that this story gets, you know, the more public support there is, the more of a chance there is that they'll let him go. Because I forgot to tell you one of the most important parts of this whole situation.
Sure.
It just you know how your mind works? It jumps around.
Oh, absolutely.
In August 2017, his solicitation charge was dropped because there was no identifiable target. So you tell me, without a solicitation, can there be a conspiracy? How can you have a conspiracy, without soliciting someone to conspire with you? So with the solicitation charge gone, they're holding him on conspiracy, which is a non charge, nonsensical charge. And so with that charge having been dropped, we're very hopeful that this exculpatory evidence will show the judges that this is nonsense and he needs to be let go. So please go to freeschafer.com and learn all about it and donate what you can to the legal fund and, you know, buy the song on iTunes.
Please, definitely. Well, we got to talk again. I got a million questions.
Go right to Schaefer's Angels.
Excuse me, I talked over you. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I was just saying half the proceeds of the song go right to Schaefer's Angels to the legal defense fund.
That sounds good. Well, we got to talk again sometime. I have a million questions swirling around in my brain about the music and the society and the heck, even the kids. I love the seven kids, man. That's a handful. I'm envious and somewhat fearful. That's a lot.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. Now, it's, you know, it's a lot of work, but it's very rewarding. And we've just got some really well-balanced, smart, loving, healthy, freedom-minded kids, and they're learning what it means to be, you know, to be libertarian. They're learning what it means to have a good work ethic and what it means to be Christians and what it means to, you know, grow up in a place where, you know, learning to work with your hands and work land and appreciate animal husbandry and crops, and like they're just getting this amazing experience that I never got, you know. Yeah. And they're just great kids, and I think that they're gonna make a big splash in this world someday. And you know, so they're, if anything that I've ever done and am doing, you know, raising these kids to be good people who believe in freedom is the most important work that I could possibly do. So
that sounds amazing. I think that's definitely one of the things we all need to be doing, like helping that next generation. We got to.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Well, it was great talking to you.
Great conversation, man.
Anyone that's listening, check out the links on AnomicAge.com. Check out the video. Buy the video off iTunes. Like you said, the proceeds are definitely going to help a very worthy cause. That's definitely something overused, but in this instance, very applicable.
Thank you so much.
Definitely. Thank you so much, man. We'll have to do it again. Be safe out there.
All right.
All right. Peace. Bye, Jordan. We're very pleased to have back on the Anomic Age, Mr. Alan Myers. He was there last week. He'll be there this week and at least for the next week as well, covering his awesome document here, Fed Ed. In case you missed it last week, Alan is a CPA and forensic accountant hailing from California. San Diego, to be exact, some 20, 29, almost 30 years in the accounting game, and a good 8 to 9 years researching the Fed, all things Federal Reserve, the banking system, the monetary system, all things money. So we're very pleased to have Alan back on the program today. If you missed it last week, we went through modules 1 through 5 of Fed Ed, and this week we'll be going through 6 through 10. So today, we'll be getting into Module 6, which is Who Creates M1 Money Today in the USA and How? So, Alan, thanks for being on the program again.
John, I'm absolutely thrilled and pleased to be here and share this information with you and your listeners. Very happy to be here today.
Definitely.
Thank you.
You bet. This is good stuff.
Well, to begin with, just to revisit M1, M stands for money, 1 stands for the number one supply. The number one supply in our monetary system is money that is considered spendable, on demand, now. That's M1 money. And there's 4 items that are included in M1. Each item is in country, meaning in the USA, in circulation. And that's all the cash, the coin, the electronic digits and checking accounts, not savings or any other accounts, just checking or demand deposit accounts, and traveler's checks issued by non-banks. Typically, I don't deal with traveler's checks because it's very small amount, very small total. So basically, we focus on cash, coin, and the electronic digits in checking accounts. Well, who creates the money? who creates the money, or M1 money, is banks. Only banks in our monetary system have the power to create and extinguish money. Bring it into existence, take it out of existence. Which for me, when people say that money is printed into existence or it's coming out of thin air, that is absolutely factually incorrect. What happens is the way banks create money is by posting journal entries into their general ledger. The typical way they do this is when somebody comes in, they want a loan, and the bank is going to loan this person or business money. Banks never, ever loan money that's already in existence. They create it. They create it by increasing the balance of a checking account. One of the big problems with this system is that because banks are the sole creators of money in our system, the only way our government can be funded is through taxation and borrowing. I did talk to one economist, and he had a third way that the government gets funded. He called it extortion.
I like it.
And to me, I think he was talking about fines, fees, interest, penalties. Today, we'll just focus on the taxation and the borrowing. Banks are the sole creators of money, but as talked about in the prior episode, banks by definition, and we'll get to it today again, banks by definition have no money in their own name. Banks and the U.S. government only have reserves. But to wrap this up, who creates M1 today in the USA? Banks do. How do they do it? They do it by posting journal entries into their general ledger, hitting enter. Keep fingertips on the keyboard. That's how it happens. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's just disturbing and amazing. I love that you're distilling this down, because I often heard the same sort of diatribe where it's like, oh, they print more money, and the average person's envisioning like a printing press from the 70s. It's just spinning around and money's shooting out the other end. So it's not like that at all.
No, it is not that way at all. In fact, I've seen some, and I believe the videos that I've watched are very well intended. They're well produced, great audio, wonderful animation. And in this one scene, you have, imagine basically a cartoon, you have this printing press. Mm-hmm. And coming off the printing press is all these dollars, you know, whatever denomination. And it's just going, going, going. And there's somebody there operating the machine. And right next to the machine, just to the left of the machine, is a sign, and it says U.S. Mint. And I'm looking at this and I go, are you kidding me? The mint mints coins. The Federal Reserve note is actually printed by the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, which is a bureau of the U.S. Treasury. It's not the mint. And it just bothered me that this little detail was overlooked. And that somehow, and this is what I find in the discussion of these topics, is people just kind of wash over really specific details, which means ultimately they don't really get it. So let's talk about a Federal Reserve note for a minute.
Let's do it.
Hey, and some of the myths related to them. Now, I will always refer to Federal Reserve notes as cash or paper. Just to be clear, it is paper, but it's not wood pulp paper. It's made out of 75% cotton and 25% linen, which to me means this can make a nice shirt. It's a nice material. One of the interesting things about the Federal Reserve note, it's the only M1 money that has the phrase, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Federal Reserve notes are referred to as legal tender. Now, I thought I understood what that meant, but I went and I did a little research. And I'm going to read this. This is a quote from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. I figure if anybody would know what legal tender means, I could count on the Department of the Treasury to tell me.
One would think.
And in part, yeah, one would think. This is what they said in the area describing legal tender. Quote, there is, however, no federal statute mandating that a private business, a person, or organization must accept currency or coin as payment for goods and or services, end quote. We all believe that legal tender, it's good for all debts, public and private, which I grew up thinking, well, you have to take it. Well, according to the Department of Treasury, there's no federal statute that says you have to. That to me is completely surprising. The other is that we'll say that it's the U.S. government that is telling us that this is legal tender and it's good for all debts, public and private. But the actual issuer of a Federal Reserve note, the actual owner of Federal Reserve notes, is the Fed itself. It's not our government. I'm still thinking about what to do. I'm still trying to think about what to do with that.
Yeah, that's
one,
a pretty big fly in the ointment.
Yes. Now, to give people a recap on the Federal Reserve note and how it becomes M1 money, I'll take you through the four steps. The four steps are, first it gets printed by the Bureau of Engraving Printing. There's a entity in the Fed called the Cash Products Office. The Cash Products Office is the one that actually orders the printing. Note the word cash.
Gotcha.
Back in the early 2000s, it was reported that each note, regardless of denomination, cost the Fed, or the Fed was charged, 6.4 cents a note to print. Today, the price varies by denomination, and it varies round numbers from 6 to 13 cents. But for the conversation today, let's just think it's 10 cents a note.
Gotcha.
This would be like any one of us going down to our local printer, ordering some flyers. We get to the printer, a stack of flyers are on the counter, and the printer is going to charge us a cost per page.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, prints up the notes, and on the loading docks of the Bureau, there could be street value, millions and millions of dollars worth of Federal Reserve notes. But to the Fed, to the Bureau, it's just a print job.
Yeah.
It's 10 cents a note. The Fed's armored trucks come pick it up. They haul it back to the Fed bank. The big steel door rolls open. The truck goes in. The engine goes off. The steel doors go down. Everything, the truck and all, goes down into the basement and they unload it. In the vaults of the Fed, street value, there could be billions and billions of dollars worth of Federal Reserve notes. But to the Fed, their accounting treatment of all of this is just a printing expense at 10 cents a note. The cost gets the same treatment as office supplies or repair and maintenance. But the thing to keep in mind is that in the hands of the Bureau, the Federal Reserve note was a print job. In the hands of the Fed, the Federal Reserve note is just a printing expense. The next stop is it goes to a bank. And the only reason banks want Federal Reserve notes is because we want them. The bank will order a shipment. To get them, their reserve account at the Fed is decreased. And these are electronic reserves, which means to the bank, all the Federal Reserve notes in their vault and teller drawers is just their reserves in physical form. It's still not considered money. It's still not part of the M1 money supply. Final stop. You go to your ATM, you get some cash out of the machine. In your hand, you now have Federal Reserve notes, and that's cash. And that's M1 cash. Your physical supply of money just increased. Your electronic digit supply, that in your checking account, just decreased. Your personal supply of money has not increased or decreased, it's just changed form. And the money supply itself hasn't changed. It's just changed form. Now, if you were to turn the cash back to the bank, the journal entries would be reversed, your electronic digit money would go up, the physical would go down, and the bank would have more reserves. So that's how a Federal Reserve note, which is printed at the Bureau, Bureau of Engraving and Printing, goes through the Fed, the banks, to you. That's how it actually becomes part of the M1 money supply, which is another way of saying that in no way, shape, or form is money ever, ever printed into existence in our system. Yes, the bills are printed, but they're not money until an electronic digit is given up for them. Does that make sense so far?
It does. I like it.
Now, some of the other myths is that, or one of the myths is that somehow, some way, a Federal Reserve note is a debt owed to someone. Well, I just described how the printed bill goes from the printing press into your wallet. At what point in time is it connected with debt? It's not. Now, the creation of M1 electronic digits, M1 in your checking account, that might be associated with debt. But the note itself is not. So when somebody says, you know, that it is, they misunderstand the process. Does that help?
I think so. It's a reserve until you get it out of the ATM. It's either the bank's reserve or the Federal Reserve reserve. And then once you actually...
Well, actually...
Go ahead.
Just to jump in, because you brought it up. Okay. I'll say people have, hold, use, spend M1 money.
Mm-hmm.
Banks and the U.S. government do not have one penny of M1 money in their own name. They only use what's called reserves. Reserves are, in essence, a separate currency from money. Money will never be reserves. Reserves will never be money. People will never hold $1 of reserve in their own name. Banks and the U.S. government will never hold $1 in their own name. They only have reserves. Now, the Fed itself has neither. Now, John, you might be saying, Alan, come on. You know, the Fed's a business. How can it not have money, and how can it not have reserves and run? And I will, and maybe I did this last time, but I'll do it again. For those who are old enough to remember or watched the TV show Star Trek: The Next Generation, Captain Picard would be in his ready room, and he'd have a replicator. And a replicator looks like a microwave oven built into a wall without a front door. And this device can be programmed to create any beverage or food item. And he'd go up to his, and he'd say, computer, tea, Earl Grey, hot. And then you'd hear this, and there in the replicator is the cup, the saucer, the tea bag, tea heated to perfection. Well, when you have a replicator, and it can create any food or beverage item, do you have any reason to have a refrigerator, freezer, stove, oven, microwave, dishes, pantry?
That's it.
Of course not. You got a replicator. Well, so taking that imagery, let's go to the Fed. Well, the Fed's got a replicator. But it doesn't make food or beverage. It creates reserves. And I know this by reading Ben Bernanke. In 2012, March of 2012, then chairman of the board, Ben Bernanke, gave a four-part lecture to students at the George Washington University School of Business. In the fourth lecture, in part, he describes how the Fed went out into the marketplace to acquire $2 trillion worth of treasuries to help the economy. He goes on to explain, he poses the question, so I guess you're wondering how the Fed paid for it. What he goes on to describe is a journal entry. And let's say for the moment, I'm the Fed, and John, you're a bank. You're the Bank of John. And you know that I'm looking for treasuries. You come to my office, you dump a bunch on my desk, I look at you, you give me a thumbs up, I give you a thumbs up, I go over to my computer, get my fingers on the keys, hit enter. I come back, John, we're cool. You look at me, you smile, you walk out. Because you know exactly what I just did. What I did on my accounting system, the Fed, is I increased an asset called U.S. Treasuries. That's a debit. And I increased the Bank of John's reserve account with a credit for the same amount. Hit enter. The Fed acquires all assets and satisfies all expenses by creating reserves. That's why it has no need for money or reserves. It has a replicator. Thank you, Ben Bernanke, for explaining this to me. And you still may be able to get the videos of him. It's the fourth one, March of 2012. I was also fortunate that at the time I was getting these, I found transcripts of what he said. And after the first hour, I was so tired of listening to him. He was not easy to listen that I just read the transcripts. But on this one part for the fourth lecture, I did go back into the video to verify that what the transcript was saying, he actually said. But that's why the Fed has no money. That's why the Fed has no reserves. It doesn't need them. It creates whatever it needs with fingertips on a keyboard. That's our Fed. Pretty nice, huh?
That's startling. Seems like the moment in the movie when the record just scratches all across the the needle there and everybody just stops and gets up. I mean, you would think that's what would have happened during this lecture series. The students would have been like, wait a minute, what did you say? Did he just say what I think he said?
I did watch part of that episode, and I read the complete transcript, and nobody posed the question, did you just say what I think you said?
Yeah.
There was none of that, which leads to another myth. How many times have you heard, John, that the Fed loaned out a bunch of taxpayer money? Especially during the crisis of 2008.
Yeah, that's another common narrative for sure.
How can the Fed, which has no money in its own name, which has no reserves in its own name, how can it loan out taxpayer money? It can't. Here's another little interesting tidbit on the Fed, and then we'll go forward. There's a booklet called the Financial Accounting Manual. This is the financial accounting manual of the Federal Reserve System. In it is, among other things, is a very long, detailed chart of accounts. For those that don't know, a chart of accounts is a listing of all the accounts in a business's general ledger. It begins with assets, goes through liabilities, equity, income, and expenses. The assets are listed in order of liquidity. So what you normally see in a regular business would be, let's say, cash on hand or petty cash, bank accounts, etc. Well, remember, this is the full, complete, total chart of accounts for the Fed. The first asset listed is called gold certificates, which is actually a receivable. What the chart of accounts is telling you is that they don't even have an account, a bank account, for any Fed bank. No Fed bank has a bank account in its own name. It doesn't need it because it creates reserves, which means if you have received a check written by the Fed, it was actually written on a bank account that does not exist, because they don't even have a bank account in their own name.
That's wild.
Last thing before we go forward, I like to read the quotes that I have from the modules, and I forgot to. Module 6, which was Who Creates M1 Money, the quote I chose for this module is, "Who controls the money controls the world." I think that's a pretty powerful statement. Henry Kissinger, 1995, Council on Foreign Relations. What is a Federal Reserve note? That was Module 7. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Which is really talking about who writes history. George Orwell.
Yeah, that's pretty spot on with what we got going on today, where people are getting taken off the internet and censored, and all the history books are having bits taken out here, and we're going to start the Vietnam War now instead of the founding of the country. Why not?
When you can rewrite history for whatever reason, there is no good reason to rewrite history unless you found out that it is factually incorrect.
True.
If it's factually incorrect, regardless of how pleasant or unpleasant it might be to our sensibilities today, we have a duty to not rewrite history. Because for me, and there was a famous quote about it, and I tweaked it a bit, the reason to know history is to know what to repeat and what not to. Well, if you rewrite it, you won't learn what to not repeat.
That's a good point.
So on Module 8, we're going to talk about reserves and how do Federal Reserve notes and coin become M1, which actually I already kind of addressed how the Federal Reserve note printed by the Bureau becomes M1. But the quote I really like for this one is, and I did look this up and it appears to be accurate, "And I sincerely believe with you, the banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies. And the principles of spending money to be paid by posterity," that means the future, "under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale." This is from Thomas Jefferson in an 1816 letter to John Taylor. They understood that you don't just keep borrowing. In fact, Thomas Jefferson, on the topic of borrowing, said, "If you are going to borrow," meaning the federal government, "then you must levy a tax at that time to be able to collect the principal and interest owed on the debt," which is another way of saying you levy a tax to pay off borrowing, and you levy enough so there is no continuing debt. And then, of course, the tax would go away. As we know today, our national treasury debt is in excess of $22
trillion. Wow.
As far, you know, what we previously talked about, how a Federal Reserve note printed by the Bureau becomes M1, coin has a similar pathway, except that it comes from the mint. And when it hits the Fed, now the Fed, when it it's charged a per note charge for the Federal Reserve notes, and it's average 10 cents a note regardless of denomination, the coins get charged at its face value. So the Fed gets charged a penny for a penny and 25 cents for a quarter.
I gotcha.
Well, the coins get treated differently by the Fed. The cost of printing Federal Reserve notes goes straight to the expense side of their accounting. The coin actually becomes an asset called inventory. Now, this is a weird inventory, because typically when your inventory goes out, it doesn't come back in. But with the Fed and its dealing with banks, coins can go out, which would reduce the bank's reserve account. And when coins come back in, the reserve account increases. but they track the coin as inventory. So you'll see it on the balance sheet. But that's basically, as we talked earlier, how Federal Reserve notes and now coins become M1 money. Coins in the hand of anybody but people in country in circulation is not M1 money. And M1 money, again, is money that is spendable on demand now. The next topic would be Module 9. This is one of my, I got to say, this is one of my fun favorites. Is the Federal Reserve System is usually referred to as the Fed, is it public or private? Well, the quote I have here is very illuminating, but not very fun. The regional Federal Reserve banks are not government agencies, but are independent, privately owned, and locally controlled corporations. Lewis versus United States, 1982, Circuit Court. I think that kind of says it. But people out there will say, oh, the Fed is quasi-public. My response is, that would be like saying a woman is quasi-pregnant.
That's it.
Doesn't happen. The question, is the Fed public or private? The short answer is, it's private. And I'll go through a handful of reasons why the Fed is private. Just to confirm, the Fed is 12 banks, 12 independent, regional, run-for-profit banks. In total, they have 23 branches. Each bank is an independent, privately owned, and run-for-profit corporation, as the Circuit Court decision said. Each bank has its own president, vice president, board of directors, and employees. Does the Department of Defense have its own president, vice president, and board of directors? I don't think so. Each Fed bank's shares are owned by the member banks within its region. You as an individual will never be able to own one share of a Fed bank. It's not publicly traded. It's not on any exchange. You have to be a member bank to own a share. And the member banks are referred to as stockholders. If you're a stockholder, you hold an interest in what? A corporation.
That's right.
Not a public entity.
Jeez. That's a pretty big one to note right there. That should resonate with everybody. You can't own any portion of a Federal Reserve Bank. So you and I could go get some stock in Microsoft or GE or Corning or what have you. But
or a bank.
Yeah, exactly. Or any of those lovely banks on the corner, but not a Federal Reserve Bank.
Cannot. I would say, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, John, I would say that entities of the U.S. government get their funding from the U.S. government. Is that fair to say?
I would think so.
Okay. The Fed banks receive absolutely zero funding from federal or state governments. That would tell me you're pretty private. So they receive no funding. These stockholders, the member banks within the region, they receive up to a 6% dividend annually based on their capital. I don't think anybody gets a dividend from Board of Education.
That's true.
But, you know, I might be wrong. The Fed absolutely refuses to honor any Freedom of Information Act request. No federal agency can do that. To audit the Fed, and we know that Dr. Paul want to audit the Fed, and just keep in mind that when they say audit, they don't mean a financial statement audit, they mean an operational audit. But to get that audit, you would need to have congressional authorization. I guess you need that because it's private, not because it's public.
Yeah, that seems kind of strange to me. So we got an entity that nobody seems to know what's going on. We can't audit it. We can't get stock in it, but it controls our entire existence, in essence.
Well, actually, to me, some of the inner workings might be really interesting just from a knowledge base. But as we will eventually talk about, if you understand the bookkeeping of banking, you'll know everything you need to know about this system. All Fed banks are subject to state property tax laws. That doesn't sound like a federal agency to me. This one I love. Substantially, and this is from their audited financial statements. Substantially, all the employees of the Fed and the Board of Governors are covered by a private retirement plan. Not the public service retirement, private. In fact, it's a multi-employer plan. There's 14 employers in this multi-employer private retirement plan. You have the 12 banks, and of course their branches. You have the Board of Governors, and there's one other employer that's part of this 14-employer private plan. The 14th employer is the plan administrator itself. This retirement plan is so private, they've included the plan administrator as part of it.
Sounds fishy.
And finally, and this, now you may have heard or you may be aware that the net coming out of the Fed is sent to the U.S. Treasury.
Okay.
Well, if you look at the audited financials, and yes, they're on the internet as PDFs. I've seen them. They get to the income statement, and they've changed the wording a little bit, but a few years ago it comes down to a net income before distribution. And let's say it's 100. And there's three items. And when you get done with the three items, it's down to zero. So what this is telling me, the reader, this is how the net income is being distributed. Okay, of the 100, let's say one goes to dividends. Two is a set aside for future events. That leaves 97. 97 goes to the U.S. Treasury. Now, in the past, they called this interest on Federal Reserve notes. Well, this doesn't make sense to me at all. One, why would the Fed be paying interest on Federal Reserve notes when it owns them? And it was charged a cost to have them printed. Secondly, when there's an interest amount, interest is typically a calculated amount, not a residual amount. So calling it interest on Federal Reserve notes, to me, is completely wrong and misleading. Now, the last time I looked at a financial, it says transfers to the U.S. Treasury. Once again, it's accurate in that it's a transfer, but it's not accurate and it does not describe what it really is. And to know what it really is you have to go back to the 1913 law, specifically page 8, section 7 under dividends. The funds that are transferred from the Fed to the U.S. Treasury, which are really reserves, it's a franchise tax.
Oh, man.
Franchise taxes are paid for the pleasure of doing business. What public agency pays the federal government a franchise tax? None. The Fed is totally, completely, and utterly private. But here's the kicker to me. We're told, and this is part of the myth for me, we're told that the Fed controls our monetary system, right?
Gotcha, yeah.
It's the whole thing together, the banks, the Board of Governors, this is, and to me, if you're in control, you got your hands on the reins.
Mm-hmm.
not just being an influencer. Well, that's not exactly correct in my opinion. You see, the Fed does get to set interest rates. The Fed does get to set the reserve requirement for banks to meet. But the Fed doesn't create money, does it? No. Only banks do. And banks have the option of creating more or less money based on what they want to do. The Fed only has indirect influence on the money supply, not direct. But here's the kicker. As we talked about, the stockholders in each Fed bank are the member banks within the region. The member banks within the region are, for lack of a better term, the regulatees. But the regulatees own the regulator. And we know that in this country, corporations are operated in the best interest of their stockholders, or they can get sued.
Exactly.
So the regulatees, the banks, own, control, and direct the regulator. And the regulatees, the banks, are the sole creators of money. So who really is running the show?
Jeez.
I'll leave you to think about that. And finally today, we're going to talk about cashless monetary systems, because these are becoming, oh, this is totally hip, totally happening.
Oh, yeah, that's the new thing.
And I would say it this way. The SEAL team will tell you two is one and one is none. And I would say it, a plan A without a plan B is not much of a plan at all. Well, when you have a cashless – well, first of all, cashless monetary system means there is no physical money. There's no paper. There's no coin. It's all electronic digits.
Yeah.
In a computer somewhere. Now, you as a person in a country that has a cashless monetary system, keep in mind that today Norway, Sweden, Denmark are pushing incredibly hard to go cashless. They really are. China is going that way too.
That should work in great with their social credit score. So if they deem that you've said something naughty online, then they can just pull your imaginary cash away.
Well, it's not imaginary, but you're not going to get access to it,
yeah.
That's for sure. And I'd love to chat with you on another time about the social credit score.
Sure, that's a big one.
And anyway, in a country that has a cashless monetary system, you have no physical cash or coin. You only have electronic digits in a bank computer somewhere. Now, where that computer is, you don't know. You have no direct access or control. Being able to go to an ATM is indirect access. To get access to your money, your electronic digit money, number one, you have to be allowed in. Two, there has to be computer access, internet access, and electricity. Any one of those fails, you have no money. Gee, what could go wrong? If you go back to the time in Cyprus and Greece, for example, or what's going on in Venezuela today, when those banks shut down, there was no, you couldn't walk into the bank, you couldn't access an ATM, you couldn't access your account via the computer. It all got shut down, which means if you didn't have physical money,
yeah,
you don't have money.
You were duly screwed.
You were totally. So for me, I don't like having only one option. Because if I only have one option, I have no choices.
Mm-hmm.
And it also means that I am totally dependent on a system that can fail or can just disconnect me for any reason. Now, one of the reasons people have been disconnected from our current monetary system, unfortunately, there is still this physical money. I read a report some years ago that Social Security, God bless them, accidentally declares 1,000 people dead a month. Now, granted, this is an accident, but it happens. You can spend months screaming at Social Security to convince them you're not dead. But until you convince them you're not dead, you are dead, which means you probably won't have access to your bank accounts. You won't have access to credit. You won't have access to your Social Security. You'll have nothing. So you better have some really good family and friends, because you're off the grid. You're out of the system. When you become totally dependent on computers, the electrical grid, and the internet, you were totally, utterly dependent. This doesn't create a stable economic monetary system. This makes people totally dependent. And if you were told, you know, if you go out, as you mentioned, if you decided to like speak out against something, you know, exercise that pesky little First Amendment.
No, that's scary. Don't do it.
And you can't find that First Amendment space on campus, and you peaceably assemble, and you do all the things that are in the First Amendment. See, I wonder why the founders decided that this would be the First Amendment. Go figure. Anyway, if you do all of that, and somebody doesn't like what you're doing and saying, and they got a friend in banking, and they go come up to you and say, listen, John, you're saying things I don't like. I know where you bank. Okay? I'm not telling you again. Okay? This is real life economic, political, financial threats. We don't want a cashless system. It makes us dependent. It makes us vulnerable. And the other thing is, this really, I had to read it because I would not have thought that this is why one of the pushes for going cashless. Let's say you're a kind of guy, you like to keep a little extra water, a little extra food, maybe some bandages, and maybe a little extra cash, just because. Because you don't know what's going to happen.
Sounds very suspicious.
Yeah, oh, you. Not only is keeping that little extra cash suspicious, but John, if you do that, you're a hoarder.
That's it.
You're hoarding money out of the system. This is bad. And one way to keep people from hoarding money out of the system is to make it all electronic. That makes us, as I said, completely, totally, utterly dependent. And finally, God forbid, of course, let's say we go completely cashless. Or one of the countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, goes completely cashless. That means all your money is in one of a couple different kind of bank accounts. And let's say you have a savings account. Well, we believe that saving money has a time value, which means money, if you save it and you let somebody hold it, you get interest income, positive interest income. Well, what would come out of a system that had full electronic money, no physical, you got $1,000 in your savings account. And after a year, you go back to take a look, and it doesn't say 1,000 plus. It says 990. You just got hit with negative interest.
Oh, yeah.
Which is another way of saying in an electronic system, fully electronic system, that does not value savings, the time value of money, they're going to charge you. And then you go, okay, well, I'll get away from this. I'll just put it in the checking account. Great. You'll just get hit with higher banking fees.
Yeah, then you have to have a minimum in the account or they'll take some more out.
And so you have no direct physical control or possibility of control of your money because it's all electronic and you are totally subject and dependent to how the system views you. And people are actually pushing for this because it sounds, oh, this is techie and this is, you know, I can use my phone.
Yeah, who needs
and that? Look at all the look look at all the funds that won't have to be, or expenses incurred to print and this and that. Oh, yeah, we're hip and happening completely. I believe that's exactly what the Lemmings were saying as they went over the cliff.
Yeah, who needs all that pesky change rattling around in those dollars?
Oh, we could just it's dirty, and this way we're going to be able to keep organized crime down they won't have physical cash. Yeah, right. Talk to the money launderers in Europe. That's not working.
Then you can just get that chip put in your wrist, and then you won't even have to have a card. You can just scan around.
Well, the beauty thing about – see, I'm glad you brought that up, because the beauty thing about getting an RID in your arm, she won't even have to remember your name.
Yeah, then you can really be stupid.
And then you probably won't even have to remember where you live, because you could put your phone over it and it would tell you how to get there. So, yeah, I mean, this is the way to maximize humanity, is become totally a cog of the system. Why be independent? Why be standalone? Why be capable of helping others who are in need of help? When you become this is to me an overdriving thought. When you become so fully dependent on a system, because you cannot stand alone, then you are really not capable of helping anyone who is in need. Because guess what? You're one of the people in need. This is dehumanizing, and it's ultimately it would be to our great detriment. One of the reasons why to know the monetary system.
Yeah, I gotta say that future sounds terrifying, but it also sounds not too far away if things keep going down the trajectory that we've been headed.
It is very close at hand, not because I think people are dumb, stupid, lazy. We've been indoctrinated to a great degree. We have trusted well past our reason to trust. And we have kind of been educated, indoctrinated to think about us and our family and our retirement, and not the full environment that we live in. And the full environment we live in is not just our city or county or state. It's our country.
That's it.
And it's about, freedom isn't free. It comes with a cost. But there's a reason why so many people for so many gazillion years have fought for freedom. Because they lived through tyranny. And if you really, really want to get an idea of how important America is, even as hurting as we are, my suggestion is go find an American by choice, especially one that has come out of Eastern Europe, which I have. And they will tell you what it was like to grow up under communism. It wasn't fun. It wasn't good. And why freedom is so important. But I would say this, freedom is a power. Freedom, liberty, rights are powers. And for a power to not be abused, power to not be abused must be controlled, directed, and monitored by responsibility, obligation, and consequence. And I say this to myself every day now, and I'd say this to anybody. What are you doing regarding the responsibilities, obligation, and consequences of your holding power? And having individual rights, liberties, freedom, that's a power. What are you doing to protect it? So you can pass it, so we all can pass it on to the next generation. That's part of our duty. And I don't think you would know better than me, I don't think our educational system has really put this into the minds of all the students. As an American, we have responsibilities, obligation, and consequences to hold the power we have dearly, take care of it, and make sure that we can pass it on to the next generations.
Wow, that's a good point. I wish people thought that way more. I feel like there's a lot of people wanting to squawk and protest about sort of silly stuff, but it's the whole forest for the trees thing. They're missing the forest, and they're just bumping into trees blindly,
Well, that's why we do this, and hopefully this broadcast will get out to more and more people, and we'll get more and more opportunities to share this with others and what's coming in the future modules. Again, this is, to me, this is all basic monetary system education, basic financial literacy that is not out there. Mm-hmm. It's not that hard to get it if you just go looking. And hopefully we'll get to more and more people. Next week, we'll begin with what is a Ponzi scheme, just to be a little teaser.
I like it. That sounds great, Alan. We got so much more to talk about. I feel like it's...
We do.
It's great stuff that most people don't know. I'd love to do one of those sort of man-on-the-street things and go out there with a sign and say, what's the Federal Reserve?
I tell you, I've done this. And I've done this with people I meet, friends, professional acquaintances. You start off with one question. What do you know about the Fed?
Yeah.
And then just be quiet. Don't say anything. This is a deer in the headlights moment. People are scrounging to say something. At most, they may speak 30 seconds. Maybe. You ask me this question, I'm still talking 2 hours later.
That's right. I try to reel myself in because I don't want to scare people away with this much information. I just try to give them little breadcrumbs so they won't run away.
Right. And that's why we're doing these podcasts in basically bite-sized forms, because after a while it's just too much information. But it is the Fed, the monetary system, is the most powerful system in the country, because everything is connected to, through, by, and with it. Yet, by and large, the vast majority of people know little or nothing about it, care little or nothing about it, and don't realize how absolutely, positively, negatively this system impacts our everyday life, which is what we're going to get to in the future podcast.
That sounds good.
So, this has been great. This has been so much fun. Thank you, John, for having me on.
Me too, Alan. I look forward to talking to you again next week, man. Thank you so much.
All right. You be safe and well.
All right. We'll
do. Take care.
Talk to you next week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you to both of our guests today, Mr. Jordan Page and Mr. Alan Myers. Blessed to have two great guests on the program today. Please check out AnomicAge.com for all things me and all things my guests, and show links, media links, videos, MP3 downloads, all that stuff. Perhaps most importantly, the donate page at the bottom. You can donate directly to me from AnomicAge.com. You can also do that from my Twitter feed. So check out AnomicAge.com for all things Anomic Age. Check us out next week as well, where we will have a bevy of information and another great guest. Until then, be safe out there. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age Project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go get some more money.